Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On tonight's episode, classic screwball comedies, Grey Gardens, and Down with Love. Kyle Turner was one of those weird little kids whose tastes were more like those of a middle-aged gay man than those of his peers. He was raised on a steady movie diet of Golden Age black-and-white comedies, and the resulting perspective that he gained set him apart from the other kids at his deeply conservative private school. He always believed he was destined to write about classic film, and through a mix of hard work and good connections, as an adult, those dreams have come true. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that I've got a book coming out next year about how subversive queer comedy transformed the American sitcom over the last half century, and I'll be revealing the title and cover of that later this month in my weekly newsletter. Head over to gaysitcoms.com to subscribe and be the first to get all the details. That's at gaysitcoms.com. Also, big thanks to everyone who supports The Sewers of Paris on Patreon. Patrons get hours of exclusive bonus videos about pop culture history, stickers and stuff in the mail, and shout-outs and YouTube videos. Now, here's Kyle.
Well, this week I'm speaking with Kyle Turner, a freelance writer whose work you may know from W Magazine, NPR, GQ, New York Times. Kyle, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt. I'm very excited to talk to you.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
The entertainment that changed my life was Bringing Up Baby, the 1938 screwball comedy directed by Howard Hawks, starring Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn.
I love this film. I've seen it so many times. I'm so excited to talk about it. How did it change your life, and when? How did you discover this movie?
I believe, like, the certainty with which I remember, like, the exact situation is a little more opaque, but, like, I know that my mother showed it to me around age 4 or 5, because I wasn't allowed to watch any of the Disney Renaissance movies as a child, so she showed me all the screwball comedies from the 30s and 40s. So Bringing a Baby is the first thing that I remember seeing and remember loving. I think at the time I didn't necessarily have the vocabulary to express like other reasons why I've come to love it, but it was the zaniness, the dynamic between Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant. I think a lot of the origins of my love for other things is found in this film. Like, its use of jazz music, the standard I Can't Give You Anything But Love, Baby is close to my heart. And also, I have a great fondness for weird animals like leopards in movies. So it was a lot of that, I think, at an early age really struck me.
So this is, can you describe for folks what this movie is if they aren't familiar with it?
Yes. Okay. So Bringing Up Baby, which was directed by Howard Hawks, if I didn't already say that, is a film about a very straight-laced paleontologist played by Cary Grant, whose name is David Huxley, and he is in the process of completing his model of the Brontosaurus at the museum that he works at, but he needs grant money to finish this model. He's trying to cajole the lawyer who is representing the woman who may possibly be able to give him the grant to finish this model of the Brontosaurus. And as he is trying to do this, the ditzy socialite turns out to be this woman's niece. And as they keep bumping into each other, he realizes that he may have like an advantage in trying to befriend her. And she is trying to basically like pull him into her life anyways. And this is played, and she's played by Katharine Hepburn. And as she drags him to Connecticut, stranger and stranger things keep happening. As like she tries to like force him into this this weird relationship, basically. Is that a poor way of describing the film?
No, that's great, and I love how it essentially it kind of describes tropes that we would recognize today as sort of I don't know, rom-com standards. You know, you've got like these two very like different characters are kind of like enemies to lovers over the course of the movie. Like you mentioned, the funny animal stuff, and then, you know, the unexpected madcap nonsense that that chases them where they go. It's just a really fun, fluffy, light, but also extremely sweet and beautifully well acted comedy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think there's actually like really interesting, I mean, besides the gender stuff, I think screwball comedies are always focused on subverting some sort of gender dynamic in which women often are able to sort of take hold of the power in a given situation. But I think there's also some interesting class stuff going on. Another thing that critic Miriam Bale has noted about the screwball comedy is that they emerged out of the Great Depression, and that the the financial circumstances of the characters often play a fairly large role in how they sort of establish the characters' power dynamics with one another. And here, like, you have someone who works at a museum, and while I can't, like, necessarily project exactly what his financial situation is, he is at a point where he does need money, like, mm-hmm. at least for his professional life. And Susan is the key to being able to access those resources. And he's when he goes to Connecticut with her, he's basically entering a world that he's not familiar with. He's not necessarily part of this, like, upper middle class or upper class lifestyle in which he has to, like, negotiate certain social rituals in order to get those things. A lot of the comedy is not only fish out of water, but specifically being able to negotiate a particular social milieu.
Now, one reason that this movie is beloved and often comes up in gay conversations is because it has the famous line, "I just went gay all of a sudden," from Cary yes. Grant. But I can't imagine it for that line had the resonance with you that it might have later in life. What was this little four-year-old seeing in this black and white movie that probably a lot of other kids would not be willing to sit still for?
I think that as a 4 or 5 year old, I was drawn to the speed at which everything is taking place. The dialogue and the physical comedy is truly, and even the sequencing of events just on a plot level, is at such a breakneck pace. You can't help but not want to be invested. You can't help but not want to engage with things that are happening one after the other. The appeal of the screwball comedy for me is that so much of this speed, especially so much of the speed of the action and of the dialogue is maybe I wasn't necessarily cognizant of it as a 4-year-old, but it was a substitute for, like, more explicit things that you couldn't do during the production code. The Hays production code limited what you could show on screen put, like, every action and that characters did within, like, a certain moral framework mm-hmm. that had to be followed within the Hollywood industry. But, like, being able to sort of at least recognize that something was happening, that the speed and the rapidity of the repartee could be both a spectacle on its own terms, but also be representative of something else. That was really exciting for me, I think, as a child. Just that there was so much going on, and that I think if I kept watching, I could figure out why it was happening. Mm-hmm. What was exciting about that? The fact that, like, Cary Grant is literally on his hands and knees following a dog looking for his bone. That was always, like, really fun for me.
So did this get you interested in other films? I know you said your mother was showing you a lot of those, like, classic Hollywood movies. Were you watching, like, His Girl Friday and stuff mm-hmm. like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that Bringing Up Baby, His Girl Friday, and The Philadelphia Story were, like, pretty much staples in my childhood viewing. I was always watching those. I loved What's Up, Doc, which is sort of a loose remake that Peter Bogdanovich did in 1974 mm-hmm. with Ryan O'Neal and Barbra Streisand. I was watching, like, other classic Hollywood films. I fell in love with Design for Living, I think, when I was in high school. The Ernst Lubitsch film with Frederick March and I'm forgetting her name. Myrna Loy, I believe. Mm-hmm. It's sort of been interesting having these reference points as a child, having those things as as gateways to love other films, because watching Bringing Up Baby or His Girl Friday then led me down a path of, like, watching different Katharine Hepburn movies like Summertime and Sylvia Scarlett, or watching other Cary Grant movies like North by Northwest or Holiday. Or watching our other Howard Hawks films. Like, I finally actually watched Red River for the first time recently. But I was always enamored of, like, what you could do even in very early film, even within the limitations of what you could do technically, that you could still be able to convey so much through dialogue, through the composition of a frame. That was always exciting to me.
You know, it's so exciting for me to hear you talking about these movies because, for one thing, years ago, a friend of mine introduced me to the movie What's Up, Doc? With Barbara Streisand. And of all the nerve, this movie, like, opens with a title card that says something like, and introducing Madeleine Kahn. Uh-huh. Like, I can't even imagine, like, having right? the balls to be, let me introduce you to Madeleine Kahn. But it was, I think it was, like, her first or second film role. So, mm-hmm. anyway, this mm-hmm. friend introduced me to this movie. And I was like, wow, that was amazing. And he's like, what do you want to watch next? And I'm like, something just like that. And he put on Philadelphia Story. And those mm-hmm. things fit together so well, separated by like 40 years or so. But they mm-hmm. feel like they're just continuous. And also, something that's kind of occurring to me as you're describing this is that there's a lot of queer subtext, and sometimes it's not even subtext, in a lot of these movies. I think Sylvia Scarlett's the one where Katharine Hepburn is posing as a man. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, she is posing as a man because she and her father have to escape from France, I believe, because of tax reasons. And mm-hmm. so she has to disguise herself as a boy. And then she is fighting off two different people who have crushes on her, including Cary Grant, who sees her as a man because she's presenting as a man. And then another woman who sees her as a man. And it's this very fun sort of triangulation of sexuality. I think ultimately what is difficult to sometimes reconcile with is the fact that the production code did offer a lot of like creative obstacles for directors and writers during that time, which I think may have allowed them to explore things that they wouldn't necessarily have been inclined to even during the pre-code era of Hollywood. Even though the pre-code movies tend to be like more explicit or tend to not be constrained by the moral framework of like someone having to be punished for being sexually transgressive or something, I think by dancing around certain things and then finding new ways to express them, you get really interesting things like the fact that not only Cary Grant jumping up in a negligee saying, I just went gay all of a sudden, but by challenging his masculinity in like a much more direct way by having his agency sort of take it away from him in a compelling way. Like Bringing Up Baby, I always think it's sort of like amusing that my mother didn't let me watch Disney Renaissance movies as a child because she was worried at the time of like some of the subliminal messaging that apparently is in the animation. I still haven't watched most of them, honestly, just because I haven't gotten around to it. But Bringing Up Baby does open in the first 5 minutes with an anal sex joke.
Does it really? I don't remember
yes,
that.
Yes. At the very beginning when, David Huxley is engaged and he's about to get married to this other paleontologist, and he is sitting on the scaffolding with this one fossil, and he's trying to figure out like where in this large Brontosaurus model it's supposed to go. And his fiance comes and he looks at her and says, what if we tried it in the tail? And his fiance, Miss Swallow, says, and very key name, Miss Swallow, says, we tried it in the tail yesterday, but it didn't fit.
Jesus. Oh my
yeah,
Lord.
1938. Incredible. Love it.
Oh my God. So were you like the weird little kid who loved classic movies, or were there other friends of yours that you could talk to about this stuff?
Oh no, I was the weird little kid that loved classic movies. I was the weird little okay. kid that loved movies, period. I did like have a couple of friends in middle school that really liked movies, they were not to any fault of theirs or anything, but like they weren't necessarily as invested in or as curious as I was about different kinds of movies. And it wasn't really until like I got on the internet in high school that I began to find other people who loved movies as much as I did and were as interested in exploring new avenues and helping teach me about different kinds of movies. If it weren't for Tumblr and Twitter, honestly, I wouldn't be the writer that I am today, and I wouldn't have like the curiosity and the passion to find and discover new things about film.
So tell me a little about like where you were growing up and what your childhood was like.
I grew up in East Hampton, Connecticut, which is dead center Connecticut. It's sort of like the Gilmore Girls town, but without the money. A very, mm-hmm. Very sort of suburban, rural, quaint I used to say that the only thing we really had to our name was a McDonald's, a Stop and Shop, and the occasional drug bust. Because whenever our town would appear on the news, it would be because there was a meth lab bust or something. And I grew up adopted. I was adopted at 6 months. My family's white. I am Chinese. And my childhood was pretty solid. I grew up going to the movies with my parents, especially with my dad. My mother liked showing things to me at home. She would show me, like, as we were talking about bringing up Baby, His Girl Friday. She showed me The Exorcist when I was 12. And I would always sneak in things about movies into my homework as an excuse. Just even if it had nothing to do with the subject, I would find a way to sneak it in there. James Bond isn't like another really big, important text for me. And I remember very vividly that in second grade, we had this math project to do that had to do with statistics or something, or like some second grade version of statistics. And I remember very vividly that I made it about the James Bond DVD collection that was coming out at the time, I think around 2002, 2003. And I had a very detailed list of all the special features and how much they would cost and all the production that would have to go into them. And I don't think I did well on that assignment because it had very little to do with the math that was actually part of the assignment.
Well, tell me about discovering James Bond. When did that happen?
I discovered James Bond when I was 7, when my babysitters let me play the GoldenEye Nintendo 64 game.
Okay.
And that was my gateway. Yeah, that was my way in. And then they also had a PlayStation 2, and they let me play 007 Agent Under Fire and 007 Nightfire. And after playing those games, they told me that they were attached to like a movie series or franchise. And I was like, well, I have to watch these. So I think one of the first things that they showed me was Goldfinger, and seeing Jill Masterson covered in gold paint just laying across a bed. There's something really exciting about that. James Bond walking out of the darkness. Seeing that, there was a lot of suspense, a lot of intrigue, a lot of eroticism. And I don't think necessarily I would have had the vocabulary to express that, but it was scintillating. It was dangerous. And I think after that, I begged my parents to let me get the Dr. No DVD when it was coming out. And this was around the release of Die Another Day in 2002, because they were re-releasing all the films on DVD. And I think James Bond functioned not only as escapist entertainment, because when I do see the movies, whenever I see a James Bond movie in theaters, I am reminded of why I love movies so much every single time, even if they are fairly mediocre. Some of the Roger Moore movies in the mid-70s, some of them are not well made. They still conjure in me like an excitement. And I think rather than being aspirational in the way that I think they tend to function, both I think more objectively and also for like other kinds of audience members, they're more like abstractions to me. They're more like amalgamations of all these unfulfilled desires of the British Empire, but also of like certain gender things. I don't think I ever really wanted to be James Bond in any real material way, but I think I thought James Bond was a fun costume to wear of a kind of masculinity that I don't think I would have ever really wanted to or could embody. Like the possibility of being suave and sophisticated and moneyed and having all this sexual and political panache was really cool, but not something that I think I ever like wanted to do as an actual person. It was purely imaginary.
Yeah, so like something that's interesting there is his suaveness and his sophistication. It is very Cary Grant.
Absolutely. And I think the connection that we can also make to queerness is that Cary Grant was sort of crafted by like George Cukor in the sense that his identity as we know him, there was a line that Cary Grant said, I'm paraphrasing, where he said something like, I don't even know who Cary Grant is. I'd like to be him. So there is the performativity to it. And I think James Bond is modeled after like a very similar sort of very early 20th century idea of white masculinity, mm-hmm. That is attuned to such a degree that like you would want to be approximate to that, but could never really be that because it doesn't exist. It is illusory. There are no real James Bonds. When Ian Fleming created him, he was sort of creating like not only a fantasy for himself, but also a fantasy of like British, white, patriarchal masculinity that is emerging after World War II. And for me, like, that was never an aspiration per se so much as it was a costume, that there could be like an abstraction element to it, because it was able to key into these very particular components to create almost a dreamy version of what that could look like, but it then sort of looks uncanny and unrealistic in a way. There's something that is so perfect and yet something imperfect about it, something strange and unsettling. But I loved that about it.
Did you find yourself like trying on different costumes, like James Bond or Cary Grant or Catherine Hepburn, or like were you like, especially being like kind of a nerdy kid with a somewhat niche interest of movies, like did you, I don't know, have a period where you're like, okay, so who am I and can I try being different types of people until I find something that works?
Not exactly, sort of. I mean, for Halloween, I did use the exact same suit 4 or 5 times as different things, and I was always either James Bond, a lawyer, a used car salesman, or a real estate agent. I think I went as James Bond twice, so that filled out the 5.
Sure.
And so my sense of self as a child was pretty much limited to bookish, kind of bland, professorial types. Uh-huh. I think the closest I ever got to really experimenting was in late middle school, early high school, when I was really into the show Monk.
Okay.
I kind of was interested in being a neurotic detective. And then I went through a phase where I was watching movies by a particular director, very well known for keying into a certain middle, upper middle class, pseudo-intellectual New York social milieu. He made films like Annie Hall in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
I got really into those. And so it was less of a costume, but I think those were much closer to the way that I did actually feel that I expressed myself in my body and in my interests. But there was also like somewhat of a critical distance to that as well. I think I've always been like very hyper aware of the way in which I inhabit a space. I think while being aware of that, I also I've never been able to necessarily help the way that I have been. As much as I would like to control it in the way that I think Cary Grant was able to control and hone a performance, or that the actors who have played James Bond, or even the sort of like facsimile of James Bond himself was able to do so, I don't think I've ever been able to be as good at it. Like, as much as I can perform in certain social situations, the core of me will always pop out, and especially when it comes to being like very opinionated. I try to be like very careful about how opinionated I am in mixed company, but I almost always say something that alienates someone by accident.
Was there a point at which queerness became basically something on your radar, something that you were aware of, potentially complicating the way that you fit in?
Yes, I was exposed to a lot of queer and LGBTQ movies as a child. Also, with the help of my mother, I watched Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar at a very young age, and The Birdcage. And I would consider Bringing Up Baby as a facet of that. And I was read as queer when I was younger quite a bit. And I didn't end up coming out until I was 19, primarily because I didn't want to give other people the satisfaction of being right.
Mm-hmm.
But like a component of my understanding of queerness was not that it was bad, but that it was maybe somewhat embarrassing, just because there were certain signifiers attached to it that are not necessarily correct, especially sort of in the minds of middle schoolers and high schoolers, and that it was very sincere and earnest and attached to like liking musicals, and that being, I think maybe shame is too strong of a word, but it was, I think I may have, as a child, imagined it as cringe.
Mm. Okay.
I was very fortunate to like grow up in a pretty liberal household. My parents took me to Provincetown a lot when I was a child on Cape Cod. And I grew up in Connecticut, which was, and the schools that I went to were pretty liberal, with the exception of my middle school that I went to from second grade to eighth grade was run by conservative evangelical Christians. And there it was definitely, I think there it was definitely like a no, a very hard no, that you, that it was not ideal to be queer in that space. But I don't, but I also don't think I was self-aware enough to sort of understand that about myself or understand sort of the implications of what that would mean.
Mm.
In 2004, I think Connecticut was discussing equal marriage, and that did become a topic of discussion amongst the adults. And because we were so young, we were not grasping that some of the subtext of certain conversations or certain monologues that our headmaster was giving. Our school was very small. It was K through 8. There were no more than 50 to 54 students at any given time total. It was such a small space that it did allow him the platform to like talk directly to all of the students, in addition to teaching fifth and sixth grade,
mm-hmm.
Which was, I think, maybe 10 to 12 students.
Oh, wow. Okay. So really small community.
Yeah. Very, very small. And then my high school was, my graduating class was 35 students. So it was a move from like a pretty conservative space to being in a pretty liberal space, but it was also complicated by the fact that being in the middle school was complicated by the fact that I was basically the only liberal, or like the self-identifying liberal,
mm-hmm.
that was hanging out with conservative people. And I spent much of my youth sort of very much aspiring or wishing that I could be like every other Christian, straight white Christian boy, even though that was not, and that was impossible to be.
Right.
And I would say that it was frustrating, but I think that those parts of my lives where I was able to embrace more progressive ideas from my parents, and then also have these really conservative talking points from close friends. Like my best friend in middle school was a conservative Roman Catholic whose family still went to Latin Mass and exposed me to like Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter and Glenn Beck. And those two parts of my life felt very compartmentalized in a way.
So you mentioned that I think it was 19 when you came out. What was that process like?
Yeah, it was a very slow resignation and realization. Mm-hmm. I knew that like being queer for other people was not a bad thing, and that one shouldn't be ashamed of it, and that queer people deserved rights. Even though my politics at the time were not nearly as well developed or well formed as they are and continue to grow as an adult. But like for other people, I didn't think it was a problem. For me, as I was saying, it felt annoying because I'd spent so long being interpolated and interpreted by the people around me as being queer. And I resented the idea that like they had figured it out before I did. It was also, I think, I was frustrated by the fact that there were certain parts of my life that I was keeping separated or compartmentalized, where I would like very adamantly pursue and have crushes on girls by day and then like be getting off to gay porn at night. And not to say that those things are mutually exclusive. Obviously, sexuality is a spectrum, but it was something that I was doing like very much in secret, even though like I ostensibly shouldn't have had any shame about it because my parents would have been accepting. And then I was at home from college for one weekend, and I was doing my usual route where I would go to the library, get some movies, go to McDonald's to get lunch, and then go to the grocery store to get a pint of ice cream and then walk back home. And that was my route, like anytime that I would be home from college.
Mm-hmm.
And I just looked at one day, I think it was in September of 2013, I guess. And I just looked at a tree and I was like, okay, I guess I like guys as well. And I just walked back home and just sort of like admitted it to myself. It was not necessarily cathartic in a histrionic or sentimental way, but it was somewhat of a relief that I could just admit it to myself and then move on to whatever the next step was of my life, whatever the next thing of being able to express or to convey my sense of self or my identity.
Mm.
And then I didn't end up coming out to my mother until like a year later, because my mother and I have a very complicated relationship. It's very Lady Bird or Xavier Dolan's Je t'aime ma mère, very tense. After my father died when I was 14, when I was a freshman in high school, and our relationship sort of imploded after that. And so I didn't think at that point we had a relationship close enough or healthy enough for her to deserve to understand that part of my life. And so I came out to basically most of the people in my life except for her until like I was cornered in a car in a Target parking lot, and then I came out to her as bisexual. And she like didn't get it at first, and then she came back about a week later, having done some research, and she called me on the telephone and she said, "So it's kind of like liking pizza and tacos." And I was like, "Sure, yeah,
all right." You know, that does sound like, you know, an effort and much better than it could have gone.
Yeah, yeah. I am thankful definitely to have a mother that was ultimately accepting, but it doesn't change and hasn't changed the fact that our relationship is very complex and fraught. But our relationship isn't fraught because of my sexuality. It's fraught because of other, like, traumatic, like, post-death reasons.
Gotcha. Did it change anything for you to be out and to be more open?
It actually, yeah. It gave me it gave me a new set of personal interests and intellectual interests. It gave me a new sense of a new way of connecting to people, absolutely. It gave me a new history to explore. I love that film and culture can function as a gateway to understanding the past, as a gateway to understanding the way that people can have creative expression. And what has always been important to me as a queer person is being able to explore the fact that that you can find unique and individual and exciting individual creative expression that has existed on the margins and has had to fight for its own existence as a valid and interesting and exciting way of making art, of making culture, of creating community, of finding ways to reflect or refract the world around it that has been historically inhospitable to those art makers, to those creatives.
Were there pieces of media that were helpful for you in figuring out or just learning more about gay stuff?
I would say that the things that were most helpful in helping me learn about gay and queer stuff were, I think early examples were films like Weekend, which I think is like an easy answer, but I think it's also a useful answer because my perspective on Weekend is that it is really great as an entryway for a very naturalistic queer romance that's very Brief Encounter-esque and treats its characters with seriousness and doesn't condescend to them. But I think it also is a really insightful film about the ways in which queer people, especially, it is very specific to like working class white British queer people or gay men, the way in which they understand their own positions within the world, their own positions within politics. And that was very interesting to me at an early age that so much of the movie that I think often people forget, and I don't blame them because like the romance is quite swoony, but I think people often forget that 80% of the dialogue is actually them talking about politics, and art, gay art, the frustrations with like assimilating into broader society, whether it has to do like on a more like material level as a person, or whether it has to do with the kinds of things that they're making, the kinds of interactions that they're having, the art that they want to use as a way to understand like what intimacy means, both within the parameters of gay and queer sociality, but also within like broader understandings of intimacy. So Weekend was a really big one. I love Paris's Burning, although I recognize it to be like a very complicated, fraught text, but that was a very big one for me when I was younger. Not only for like the way that it can, that it was able to like break down terminology that then sort of like got subsumed by like a broader, normative culture. But also I am of the belief that Livingston does show like a modicum of tenderness to their subjects. And I was always really interested in how like insightful they were and how shrewd they were about their own place within the world and their own desires. That was always really exciting to me. And then Grey Gardens was a really big one for me. Mm. I think I have somewhat, and I say this with the utmost admiration, and respect, but I tend to like sometimes have the taste of an old queen. I do love my Judy and Barbara, and I do love Grey Gardens because it is very sad. I have never gravitated as much to like the camp readings of Grey Gardens, and I think I have a complex relationship to the way that camp as a framework is used often in contemporary discourse or contemporary conversations. But I think Grey Gardens has a real tenderness to its subjects that I don't think that audiences are always taking note of. I don't think it is making fun of little Edie. I think it is very sympathetic to her, but she just is often like using her words as her own like noose, basically.
It's an interesting way to look at it. And something else that it occurs to me is that something about those characters is really similar to Katharine Hepburn, and you know, not just in Bring Up Baby, but also in Philadelphia Story. Just you know, these really uninhibited, I guess, characters who come in and. Mm-hmm. You know, in a lot of those movies, rescue the more placid or, I guess, domesticated male. sometimes, not always, but I don't know. It sounds like there's movies with freewheeling women saying like, "Hey, there's a big, wide, exciting world out there where you don't have to be so buttoned down as you used to, Brian O'Neill."
Exactly. It's. You can do whatever you want and you don't have to apologize for it. And I am often skeptical of sentimentality, mm-hmm. but when it's done well, when it's earned itself, that is the quickest way to my heart. And I think there's something in Little Edie's ethos that I think is very admirable and very sweet. And although obviously like the circumstances of her later existence, especially in that film and other nonfiction films that were made about her and her mother, are not ideal. I think that she does have like such a courageous sense of self and self-assuredness that I wish I could have in a way. I think I am like pretty self-assured in certain respects, but there is such a bracing quality to what she likes and what she loves. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she and her mother just like sing old standards, like old jazz standards are some of my favorite things in the world. But the fact that she just like sings them in their little house, or their large house rather, and that she dances on the main floor with the American flag, just she's certainly putting on a performance, and that is the way that she knows how to live. But I think even if there weren't a camera there, there'd be something in her that like would crave having that burst of energy.
So tell me about the writing that you do now. You write for NPR, New York Times, GQ. Tell me more about how you got into that and what you write about.
The more truncated version is that, as I was saying, I've been sneaking in things about movies into all kinds of writing and all kinds of schoolwork since I was in second grade. But when I was 13, someone told me that I was really opinionated and said that I should start a blog. And then I did. I started a blog when I was 13. And when I was in high school, I saw on Twitter that there was a call for news writers for a now defunct entertainment website called veryaware.com. And I sent in some of my blog posts as clips and a little cover letter. And they took me on and I did some news writing, which was, you know, fine. But it gave me the opportunity and the platform to explore other kinds of writing. And I started writing essays for them. And from there, when I was a senior in high school, freshman in college, I started pitching to actual editors and started pitching essays, interviews, reviews, etc. And since then, I've had the great fortune and wonderful opportunities to work with some really great editors, work for some really fantastic publications. I've wanted to be some kind of film historian or film critic since I was 7. And I feel very fortunate that even though I have a day job, because I do like having a steady stream of income, that I am basically living a really good version of my dream, where I get to write about what I like to write about and what I want to write about pretty much at my own behest or like at my own luxury. I generally don't have to write about things that I'm not interested in. Like, I don't have to cover movies that I am not naturally wanting to see, like Marvel movies, unless someone approaches me and asks me to write about them, which I'm fine doing. But if I don't have to, I can sort of extend my interest to the things that I am really passionate about, like Stephen Sondheim's Company, or I recently wrote about Everything Everywhere All at Once for W Magazine, and I wrote this longer essay sort of using this one moment as a way to sort of zoom out and extrapolate about its perspectives about masculinity and race and film comedy.
So if folks want to check out your writing and follow you online, where should they go?
They should find me at tylekerner.com. That's TYLEKURNER. Just a spoonerism of my name. And then that is also my Twitter and Instagram handle at tylekerner. And you can find me on there having lots of opinions or making dumb jokes about Down with Love. I rewatched Down with Love last night with a friend, and it's a miracle that that movie exists. It's really wonderful.
It is. You know, I watched it maybe about a year and a half ago or so, because I had really warm memories of seeing it in the theater when it came out. And it is such a strange artifact. Like, it's one of those movies that maybe you have the same feeling too. Like, when I watch it, I'm like, why did they make this movie specifically for me? Who else would want this
me? Yeah. Yes, I am just enamored of it. I think I've rewatched it maybe 2 or 3 times this year alone. And I am very curious as to like what the pitch was from producers to make not only a period piece, but a period piece that is a pastiche. Like, it is using the same visual language as the light sex comedies of the early 60s with Doris Day and Rock Hudson. And that those have like a very particular timbre to their comedy that you wouldn't expect would make sense in, you know, the early 2000s. But it just works so well because I think it is able to use, my friend used the term retrofuturist, and I think that really accurately describes its perspective about the sexual and gender politics that it's exploring, because it's able to, as opposed to like looking back at the 60s with a certain condescension, it instead uses the language of like mod 60s and those early sex comedies as a way to look at contemporary sexual politics and the way that like market feminism has shaped our world and the inevitability of market feminism being like American capitalism. Mm.
Yeah, it's just a wild imagining of what if we took a movie from that time and transplanted it today, kept to the setting in that time, but kept the mm-hmm. but it updated the sensibilities. It's such a strange, like, it feels like like you're traveling through time when you watch that film.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the performances are just delicious. I've been a fan of Sarah Paulson ever since that movie.
Mm-hmm.
She's just delicious as Vicky, Renee Zellweger's book agent and editor.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great, there is a really wonderful duet between Renee Zellweger and Ewan McGregor at the end of the movie. So stay for the credits. And it uses one of my, it exposed me to one of my favorite jazz songs, Down With Love. And there's really, back to Barbara Streisand and Judy Garland. Judy Garland is sort of appears as a faux cameo in the film. And then Barbara Streisand also has an amazing version of that song, I believe on her second album, which is longer than the one that appears in the film and incorporates this like parodic use of other jazz standards within it, which I think is really fun.
Mm. I'm so pleased to like squeeze in a recommendation for Down With Love at the end of this conversation. I'm so pleased. Kyle, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun. Long time listener, first time caller. So glad to be here.
Yay. Awesome.
Thanks to Kyle for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everybody who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaum to support the show and get backer rewards like stickers in the mail and patron-only bonus videos. Check out my YouTube channel for stories about pop culture. That's at youtube.com/MattBaum. And subscribe to my weekly newsletter at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from thefilmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.